Welcome to Tuesday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, travel writer Alicia Underlie-Nelson gives her best advice for spring break and summer travel and travel to Canada and Europe during these politically sensitive times. Plus, a Plains book, essay, Pie Melons, a forgotten taste of Plains identity. And of course, that's from Dr. Tom Ezern. And with milk prices stuck below profitable levels, Midwest dairy farmers are finding creative ways to stay afloat. We begin Main Street today by talking about low oil prices that are forcing major producers to tap the brakes on new drilling. And in Williston, in northwest North Dakota, the ripple effects of oil and gas production are always a concern. Continental Resources, of course, is one of the state's largest oil producers. They say it will pause all drilling in North Dakota for the first time in 30 years, even as it continues pumping oil from existing wells. And state officials emphasize the company is not leaving the Bakken, but fewer drilling rigs can mean fewer workers, less local spending, and pressure on city revenues, and that communities like Williston know it all too well. And to help us understand what this pause could mean for the city, from jobs, population, sales tax collections, and long-term planning, we're joined again by Williston Mayor Howard Klug. Mayor, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you for having me again.
Mayor, since we visited last time, the city has announced excitingly that a new Target store is planned to open, more than 134,000 square feet at Williston Square, making Target's first location in western North Dakota and its sixth in the state. City leaders, including you, say the decision reflects confidence in Williston's economy and long-term growth and represents a major milestone in the development of Williston Square as a mixed-use hub. But Mayor, I have to ask you, that was before the announcement from Continental Resources. What's changed in your forward trajectory here?
Well, one of the things that we look at is we look at everybody. You know, Continental's got such deep pockets that the first hint of we're going to get back into Venezuela. And right after that, they announced that they're going to be doing some shale development down there. Continental's got such deep pockets that, yeah, they can do whatever they want. We look at other things that are going around here. And, Target was a great accomplishment for the city of Williston, but it's not whatever it was, $4.4 billion worth of generation plant that's being built 20 miles from Williston that's relying on Bakken gas to provide power to the rest of the North Dakota, rest of the country, all the way down to Texas, because they're part of that big grid. So, and then also the smaller players out here, and they're not Continental by any means, but Kraken Energy has picked up a couple of rigs, and Torrid Energy, I believe they've got one. Then Phoenix Energy is doing a lot up in northwestern Williams County and into Divide County up there, and even going over to Montana to do some exploration on the fringes of the Bakken. So whether or not this is going to have a long-term effect, you're right. It depends on the price of oil. It depends on how easy it is to get out of the ground. We know it's there. And every time you turn around, that there's a new technology, new development to allow them to get even more and more oil and gas out of that formation that's down there. And who knows, maybe that it shifts entirely more to natural gas. We'll have an abundance of that. They're still going to build a pipeline that goes all the way to Fargo to power a lot of different generation plants throughout that. So energy is still going to be a big part of our overall scheme out here in western North Dakota. And as a city ourselves, in this last budget cycle, we were very conservative. And if you've read anything about Williston, we've had issues with police and fire and public safety, whether to take grants, whether not to take grants. That's another story, but we looked at all of those kind of things to make sure that you always try to stay one step ahead and those kind of things. And we could feel a slowdown a little bit, especially with the majors consolidating and those kind of things, where the dollars are coming in for new investment in this area. But overall, I'm pretty optimistic that what has been proven to work in the Bakken in the past is going to be even better now. And the main problem will be is to make sure that we can get it out, any oil that's produced out into a market that can sustain maybe at $65 or something like that. I think that they'll figure it out that that $65 range will still entice people to be out here in western North Dakota. It's not 100, but we've always said that 70 would work real well for us.
And of course, oil prices fluctuate over time. And who knows, a year from now, we could be talking about oil that's 80 or 90 bucks a barrel. Just so hard to predict and tell. So what you're telling me, Mayor, I think is relative to the budget that you looked forward to in the coming year in 2026, you're not going to change things too much. Is that accurate?
That's correct. And will there be layoffs out here? Yes. Will there be other opportunities for folks out here? There always has been. I think that with the pullback and a reset, the next go-round, which I think is going to be sooner rather than later, because, once again, all the permits are in place. The leases have been signed. There's production holding those kind of things. So when this does rebound, all of those things are in place out here in western North Dakota, so we're not starting from scratch. And we've got a pretty good roadmap of what we need to do out here. And you mentioned, yes, is it going to affect sales tax? Well, absolutely, it's going to hurt our sales tax numbers because a lot of that sales tax comes from oil and gas. It comes from the sand. It comes from frac sand. It comes from pipes. It comes from a lot of different things that go into drilling new wells. But to redo these wells and et cetera, there's still dollars coming in. Diversifying our shopping is going to be a big boon for out here in Williston, so we will get more sales tax dollars on those kind of things. The property tax revenues, we're not going to be able to rely on those at all. We did get additional funds from the state of North Dakota, and we're working hard on rural medicine, and with the special session last week, we're going to be meeting tomorrow about where we can apply for those kind of things to get more medical services out here in western North Dakota. So as you can see, I've got my fingers into a lot of things out here. I've got a lot of things on my mind and those kind of things. But I'm pretty confident that we've budgeted well. We've been through this. A lot of us has been through this before. We know that conservative budgeting has worked well for us in the past, and I believe that's where we're going to have to be for the next probably two years at least.
That's Williston Mayor Howard Klug. We've been discussing the impact of Continental Resources, one of the state's largest oil producers, saying that it will pause all drilling in North Dakota for the first time in 30 years, even though as it continues pumping oil from existing wells. Mayor, it's always a pleasure. Thanks again for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you very much for your call today. Appreciate it.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We continue on this Tuesday with a gal we periodically visit with. She is Alicia Underly Nelson, who joins us, and she talks about travel. She's a freelance writer and photographer who specializes in immersive travel stories. Alicia, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
We've got a little bit to cover today. We want to talk about spring break. We want to talk about European travel in light of current political strife. Same thing with Canada. Even think about the 4th of July with all of what's happening in the state, of course, with the opening of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. So, Alicia, for our listeners who may be new to your work, remind us of what kind of travel stories you're most drawn to and what you look for when deciding where to go next.
I'm really looking for places that are grounded in community. I want maybe a little bit slower travel if you're doing the top five things and you're stopping in for 5 seconds to get a photo to prove that you've been there. That's really not my jam. I like to know, I like to get to know a place through the eyes of the people that live there. So I am all about, you know, slow road trips, train travel. I definitely do fly, but I really want to go and like dig down and find the heart of a place. So I think there's sometimes we get so obsessed with acquiring passport stamps and seeing all the things and sticking to an itinerary when we travel. And I like to do kind of the opposite, just to stretch out, relax, and maybe take some suggestions. Go to the barista's favorite restaurant and then let the server there tell me the next place to see. I think it's a little bit less stressful. I like travel to be a break and a chance to see something new and unwind a little bit, because I think sometimes we forget how to do that in this busy modern age.
I think that is such wise advice, and I struggle to do that, quite honestly, because of itineraries, right? We have to be at point A at a certain time and point B at a certain time. So I think that is advice that I've thought about in the past, and I'll try to remember. I want to talk about spring break as we kind of begin, and it means different things to different people. Some just like to rest at home maybe for a period of time. What are the trends this year? What do you think people are looking for? Are they looking for rest? Are they looking for adventure? Are they looking for experiences? Something in between?
They're looking for a little bit of everything. Of course, it depends on what kind of spring break you want. If you are a spring breaker yourself, you're going to want to go to all the places where college-age folks are gathering, and that can really vary. Typically warm weather, but you've got folks gathering on the coast of Texas. Florida is always very popular. Mexico is pretty popular. Nashville, Tennessee has seen kind of a rise of popularity in numerous groups. So that's a great place. Maybe have some adult beverages, dance on the beach, maybe go to the bar, that kind of experience. If you're looking for a more family-oriented option, there's plenty of options there too. And we are about, 7 or 8 weeks away from spring break, which is optimal time to plan a plane trip. Tickets are typically available and they're good prices. They tend to get less available as we get closer to the date. So especially if you're traveling with a group, now's the time to think about that. And if you're traveling out of North Dakota specifically, Las Vegas, L.A., Denver, Arizona, typically a pretty easy jaunt. You get warmer weather. Even Denver is going to be significantly warmer from here. If you want to try something a little different, maybe consider, this direct flights out of Fargo to Atlanta. And that is something that, maybe new on some people's radar, maybe haven't experienced Georgia. And that also opens up some connecting flights through the region that would be a little bit more accessible, a little bit more affordable for people, and don't take quite as much planning as they would have in the past. Now, if you want to go international, the Caribbean and Mexico are always really popular. If you're like, I'd love to do that, but you know what? I haven't renewed my passport. That's okay. You don't need one to go to the U.S. Virgin Islands or Puerto Rico, and I would highly recommend Puerto Rico. It was an absolute blast. We got a deal, went there a few years back, and just really enjoyed that. Get the good weather, plenty of time to get back and forth. Flights are not a terribly long haul. Or you can, go out on a limb and do that European trip that you've been talking about. I just ran numbers from a couple different destinations out of North Dakota for a one-week trip in March. Really good prices for Paris and Lisbon. Nice rates for Rome, Athens, Edinburgh, Scotland. So a lot of those, big bucket list trips are surprisingly affordable, and some smaller cities are too. And that's not always the case for spring. A couple of years ago, we were considering a trip to Germany, and one person could fly for the price that I would normally pay for five, So it just, sure, it's not always the case, but it's looking pretty favorable for going to Europe this year as well, if that's something that you want to try.
Alicia, I want to ask you about that. Some travelers, I think, are feeling hesitant maybe about Europe right now because of current political tensions. From your perspective, how should people think about that risk realistically, and is there a risk, and are there parts of Europe that still feel especially welcoming to Americans or well-suited for American travelers?
Yes, definitely. I actually, because the last time I was in Europe was several months ago, I wanted to check in with friends that have traveled abroad more recently, because, of course, the political situation in our country has changed, and that influences, our relationships with other nations. They largely reported that there were no issues, other than the fact that people were pretty baffled and frustrated by the political situation in the U.S., and people were talking to them about it. But by and large, I have a friend in Germany who was talking to a colleague from the Netherlands and said, folks in the U.S. sometimes a little bit suffer from main character syndrome, where we think everybody's following our news super closely. That's not necessarily the case. And they're really good at understanding that the government does not necessarily represent the people of a country. And several people, I talked to friends in Spain, Germany, and the UK, as I said, and they were interviewing their friends and their colleagues who come from all over the world. And they said, honestly, if you're someone that's traveling to Europe and you regularly travel to Europe, you're probably not the kind of person that they worry about. They're not the, you're not the kind of person that's going to be critical of immigrants. You're not the kind of person that's going to be rude to the residents of their nation. You know what I mean? You're somebody that's a citizen of the world and you understand your place in it. That said, I do want to kind of read a quote of a friend of mine from Spain. She said, I really don't think there's any consequences of Trump's actions in this space, meaning in her home country. But if you mean the other way, us going to the U.S. now, that is different. And I should add, they come here often. She said she really wouldn't recommend her daughter coming to stay with us now, which is something that we've chatted about in the past, simply because, I mean, she would be legal to be here. She would have a student visa to be here. But they're very alarmed by the fact that protected immigrants, whether they have, you know, student visas, whether they have green cards, this administration doesn't appear to be honoring those. And they find that to be really scary. And that's something that I heard time and time again. There are folks saying they would not be comfortable coming here. And that does appear to be kind of borne out by the numbers. From January to October this year, travel from Western Europe was down 3.5%, according to U.S. Travel and National Report. And I worry that that is going to increase because that is before all of these immigration actions really kicked up. And I would add that there are lots of folks, especially, you know, recent immigrants, black and brown folks who are U.S. citizens that are rightfully very alarmed, especially our neighbors over in Minnesota. That's my home state. In December, a friend of mine said, you know, I'm worried about going to a conference in Minneapolis. And I said, I don't think you have to worry. And I have changed my advice to folks because my friends on the ground in Minneapolis are having to carry their passports and in some cases adoption certificates around with them to prove
I'm so sorry to hear that.
That they are citizens. And that's alarming. So I think going to Europe, not going to be an issue for most folks, with the exception of if you're a green card holder. If that's the case, the National Immigration Law Center is urging great caution, urging folks to make a safety plan. They're advising that the Trump administration is trying to detain and deport some green card holders for political activity, which is a protected activity, but they're concerned about that. If you have past crimes, even small ones like a marijuana violation in a state where it's now legal that's been expunged, that can be a concern. So I would say travel to Europe is fine for some folks, travel abroad, but for some folks who are green card holders, that is a way that you can really be flagged by the system, and they recommend making a safety plan and consulting your lawyer. So I think travel abroad, it really depends on who you are, it depends on your legal status, it depends on the advice from your immigration lawyer, and it depends on your tolerance of risk. And that, as a travel writer, is something that is real alarming for me to say about my own country, because these advising citizens of a country about checkpoints and needing to show documentation is the kind of thing that I would discuss in an occupied country. And to have that happening in my home state is just, I mean, it's an unprecedented situation. And I really need to state how unusual that is.
Yeah. We're joined periodically by Alicia Underley Nelson. We're enjoying our conversation with her. She's a freelance writer and photographer who specializes in immersive travel stories. Lisa, let's talk about Canada. We've heard, of course, that there are fewer Canadians that are coming to North Dakota and to this part of our country, and certainly probably all of America. What about going to Canada? I think it often gets overlooked in spring and early summer. Is it a strong option right now?
It is. Yes, it definitely is. I would say my contact with my Canadian friends, I have a lot of friends in Canada, the majority of them in the Prairie provinces. So they have a lot psychologically in common with us here in our part of the U.S. So I think that that is probably the easiest trip abroad for most Americans in our part of the world, because it feels super similar, but you still get enough difference that you have that adventure feeling. And Winnipeg especially is a super easy drive for many of us. I've also had a really wonderful time in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, that I really recommend both cities. If you want a city break that feels a little bit different, again, I would say crossing an international border carries risks for some folks, especially green card holders. And so you want to take that into consideration when making your travel plans. But as for your welcome in the country itself, again, Canadians are very good at understanding the difference between the citizens of a country and the lawmakers of a particular country. And yes, Canadians have largely been staying away from the U.S. 64% of Canadians, according to the Pew Research Center, held a negative view of the U.S. in 2025, which is definitely the highest ever recorded in the 2 decades of polling. And they have been showing that by boycotting our country. And that is definitely their right. Our president said he wanted to make them the 51st state, and they took issue. And that's certainly their right. But I would say that they do not, from what I've seen at all, appear to extend any of that frustration towards us as people. And I really recommend, Winnipeg and Saskatoon are super fun, wonderful food scenes, just always new and interesting restaurants popping up. I have a list a mile long for both cities, world-class museums, wonderful strolling cities, excellent shopping, and they're so close. I mean, we overlook them often. We think we have to get on a plane to have this kind of experience, but it really is that wonderful, immersive feeling where you know you're in a different country, you have that adventure. But for Winnipeg especially, I always like to recommend that for folks that live in the eastern part of the state, because it is the simplest way to have an international adventure you can ever imagine. You just get on I-29 and drive
north,
and that's it.
That is it.
It's so easy.
Alicia, I want to talk about the 4th of July time and early summer also. It is going to be an exciting time for our state with the opening of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. Have you thought about that from a travel perspective?
Oh, this is going to be the biggest travel news in North Dakota in a generation, if not more, because we get travelers from all over the world who are Western enthusiasts, who are Theodore Roosevelt enthusiasts. They make pilgrimages to Medora already because of Theodore Roosevelt's deep history there. He ranched there for several years in the late 1880s. And so they come and they see the national park that bears his name. And for this library to open in time for the nation's 250th birthday, it's just huge. It's perfectly timed. I think we're going to see an influx of people coming here. And I would say, even if you're not a Theodore Roosevelt history buff, the building itself is an absolute wonder. It's a $450 million structure. It's carbon neutral, and it's just fascinating. People really should look up photos of this. It's a green roof planted with these native prairie species, and it absolutely just disappears into the Badlands Bluff and kind of just becomes a part of the landscape. So you have these unobstructed views of Theodore Roosevelt National Park, and the walls inside, they're rammed earth, so they kind of echo the stripes on the Badland rocks. They brought a tree in that was actually planted by Roosevelt in New York, and that was actually reimagined now as a lectern and a conference table. So like every single thing in this space has this meaning. It's very interesting. And yes, you can follow Roosevelt all the way through 8 periods of his life, you know, from ranching and hunting down through his political career. Oh, you can just kind of enjoy the shaded pavilions, go up on the rooftop. There's a path that circles the site, and it connects with the Mottohay Trail, which is one of the most beautiful hiking, biking, and horseback riding trails I've ever seen. So it's just a really great place to connect with nature as well, if history is not necessarily your thing. And if you're really excited about this and you cannot wait until the 4th of July when it opens, I get it. They have virtual events and book talks and curator talks on the event page, and they're adding more all the time. So people can kind of participate even before the doors open. I think it's going to be really exciting. A gorgeous building and hugely important for our state.
My guest has been Alicia Nelson, and she joins us periodically here on Main Street. She's a freelance writer and photographer who specializes in immersive travel stories. You can learn more at alicia_nelsonconsulting.com and at prairiestylefile.com. Thanks, Alicia.
Great. Thank you.
Still ahead on this Tuesday's Main Street, pie melons, the forgotten taste of Plains identity from our good friend Dr. Tom Ezern. It's his Plains Folk essay, and how dairy farmers are trying to stay afloat. That and more. Stay with us. This This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and in this week's Plains Folk by historian Dr. Tom Easern, Tom explores how food ways shape regional identity through a nearly forgotten staple once shared by German-Russian communities on the Northern Plains and German settlers half a world away. It's a story of culture, memory, and a humble pie melon.
Since I spend a ridiculous amount of time reflecting on the character of regional identity as an intellectual obsession, but also think a lot about food as a personal obsession, it is no surprise that these two preoccupations intersect and cross-pollinate. Foodways feature powerfully in the self-identification of cultural and regional identity. Recently, for instance, I talked about how German Russians in South Dakota have deployed shishlik as a cultural icon. Last November, Dr. Kelly and I spent time in a new research area for us, the Barossa, an enclave of South Australia settled in the 1840s by German-speaking Prussians or Silesians. Theirs is a complicated ethnic and regional identity. Evangelical Lutherans, well, like me, they kept to themselves as much as they could for generations. But then came the Great War, when their neighbors of English ancestry would not leave them alone but sought to eradicate all things German. If you're from someplace like, McIntosh County, North Dakota, you know what I'm talking about. One front of the campaign for cultural suppression was culinary, which included publication of a cookbook in English entitled Barossa Cookery. German culinary tradition was almost completely absent from the compilation. It was all English stuff. German tradition survived, however, and reappeared alongside the English in subsequent revisions of the cookbook. In the late 20th century, developers strove to establish the Barossa as a New World center for winemaking based on that noble grape, Syrah, rebranded as Shiraz. Tourism goes hand in hand with winemaking. And developers found the exhibition of German ethnicity was great for tourism. Exploring this real and imagined region of Australia, particularly the beautifully historic community of Tanunda, we happened into an independent bookstore, the Raven's Parlor. My eye fell and my interest fixed on a recent book, Barossa Food, by a daughter of the country, Angela Heutzenreder. This woman not only gives me recipes to try at home, but also is my new model for how to write about food in regional culture. In the Barossa, as Heutzenreder recounts, there was a food, a melon, the German-speaking people called Pompen, and English speakers called pie melon. This was not a German introduction. I think the connection was British Imperial, coming to Australia by way of South Africa, possibly South Asia, possibly the Near East. The Barossa Germans, however, appropriated the pie melon and made great use of it, often mixing other fruits for pastries, jams, and sauces. All this resonated because pie melons were known and used, too, on the Northern Plains. And here, too, the connection is imperial. The culture of pie melons, although present among various immigrant groups, was most prominent among the Germans from Russia. They acquired this small, round, tough-skinned, white-fleshed, bland-tasting melon as settlers in the Black Sea colonies of the Russian Empire. Thence it came as cultural baggage to Dakota Territory. Nowadays, we call pie melons citron, and hardly anyone knows anything about them. Back in the 1990s, the garden writer Daryl Kaler wrote some columns prompting comment from several folk who grew citron and used it, often for candied melon, as in fruitcake, or for sauces. There has been, however, to my knowledge, no citron revival on the plains. Citron were once widely grown and much talked about on the Great Plains, however, and I'm prepared to tell you about it. In the meantime, if you are an aficionado of pie melons, I'd love to hear from you.
That's Plains Folk by Dr. Tom Easern from North Dakota State University. And you can find more Plains Folk essays online at Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating 70 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A group of young Indigenous men spent a week on the Wind River Reservation for a photo camp with National Geographic. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman attended a showcase for the student photographers who camped, fished, and helped with a bison harvest while honing their photography skills. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to her about the experience.
Can you tell us a little bit about the photo camp and what the students did there?
So this is the third year that Nat Geo's hosted this kind of camp in Wyoming. The big picture idea is pretty simple. It's all about mentorship. Professional photographers partner with young people in different places around the world, and they spend a week learning together and taking photos. The crew this year was made up of folks from the Wind River Reservation and the surrounding area, and from the Menominee Reservation in Wisconsin. They spent the week at Crow Creek, which is in the northwest part of the Wind River Reservation. That was their base camp. They hung out with an orphan baby bison named Ruby, visited by bison jumps, and just got to explore, hang out, and take a lot of cool photos. And it was an all-guys group. National Geographic explorer Ronan Donovan helped organize the camp with Indigenous community members and explained the why behind that choice.
Young men are struggling in disproportionate ways to young women, and the ripple effects throughout communities and societies, I feel like, is profound.
You recently attended a showcase for the photo camp. Can you describe some of the photos you saw and what that event was like?
The showcase was really special. It was on a Friday night at Central Wyoming College at the Intertribal Education and Community Center on campus. There were families and kids and elders too. Everyone piled into this classroom and watched a slideshow on a big screen projector. The photos were super stunning. There were a few that really stood out to me. A silhouetted hand reaching into the sky, Ruby the bison resting its head on someone's chest, a grandmother and her granddaughter with their faces lit up by the sun. And after the slideshow, the group sang this prayer song for everyone.
You spoke with some of the photographers. What did they have to say about the experience?
They had some great reflections. I chatted with one in the hallway right after the slideshow.
My name's Corey Budley, and I'm a student photographer for National Geographic. Could I say that?
Budler's about to be a senior at St. Stephen's High School on the Wind River Reservation. He said meeting new people and having new experiences were highlights, but one thing definitely stood out.
I've never seen a buffalo get harvested before, so that was pretty crazy to see.
He came to the photo camp last year too, but he still had some new takeaways.
Learning about portraits, how to take portraits, and messing around with light. I think most of my favorite pictures were like landscape. I took a photograph, it was of like some wheat. It was kind of dark, a little moody. It was like cloudy sky, and I really liked it.
I also talked with Jackson Taylor. He's 18 and just graduated from Moscow High School in Idaho. Taylor said the bison harvest was a huge highlight.
After the buffalo was killed, seeing the herd gather around it and doing their dance for it and respecting it, it felt like as many emotions as we had that day, all those buffaloes had the same, if not more intense emotions and feelings.
He also had some more technical takeaways.
I learned that I tend to crop the bottom and the top out of every image without fail. So I think when it comes to lessons, that's the biggest is zoom out more.
So one more question for you. You report on a lot of different Indigenous stories in the region. What was unique about this story that made you want to cover it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think photography and storytelling are super powerful tools. And who's behind the camera or the microphone or the pen, I think it makes a big difference. But Jackson Taylor, who we heard from earlier, summed it up way better than I can. He said the group talked a lot about this idea of photography as a weapon.
It's not a weapon that kills. It's a weapon that reveals truth, knowledge, and information. And it's one that gives instead of takes. And I don't think there's another weapon like that on the planet. So I want to use that weapon in my life to give as much as I can and wield the camera responsibly, as we all should.
Taylor told me he wants to make a career out of photojournalism or documentary filmmaking. And really, this whole event gets me psyched for the next generation of storytellers.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Dakota Medical Foundation reminds listeners of Giving Hearts Day, February 12th, a 24-hour event supporting charities in North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota. Since 2008, donors have helped raise more than $226 million. Details at givingheartsday.org.
Milk prices are now below many dairy farmers' break-even point after a steady price decline since January of last year. It's the latest symptom of a volatile milk economy that's pushed some farmers to open side businesses to stay afloat. Harvest Public Media's Tadeo Ruiz Sandoval reports.
Quincy Schmidt's family has owned their dairy farm in Corcoran, Minnesota, an hour outside of the Twin Cities, since 1958. When her grandpa first scouted the area.
He hopped in his pickup one day and he bought the farm with 20 cows and a horse, and we kind of have grown our farm from there.
When Schmidt was growing up, the family had about 50 cows, and the herd expanded over time.
As we became adults and were interested in the farm, we increased our herd. We're now milking 120 cows, and yeah, they're pretty friendly. They're a friendly bunch.
But for the past 5 years, dairy prices have been volatile. They're currently running a few dollars below many farmers' break-even points. Profit margins at Schmidt's family's farm started shrinking.
Dairy isn't always a consistent form of income. If other dairy farmers can relate, the prices are pretty low. They've been very low for a while. It's not always the same check you see coming in every. It's not a consistent check.
Thus, their side business, Curious Cows and Company, was born. For $25, visitors can spend 30 minutes snuggling calves, brushing their coats, or feeding them hay. I tried filming myself cuddling with cows, in fact, until one of them thought my hair was edible. In the business. Ah! But why have dairy prices been declining? One part of it is that there's a dairy glut that's outpacing demand. Christopher Wolf is an ag economist at Cornell University. He says people tend to consume a lot of these dairy products when they eat out.
They're more likely to, people eat more cheeses, more specialty cheese in particular, and things like that when they eat out.
But he says with inflation still relatively high, people are eating out less, and that cuts into dairy consumption.
So right now, inflation is still being kind of stubborn. And everything that's happening right now doesn't look like it's going to do much for curbing inflation. When people go out less, it also has impacts.
Which is precisely why dairy businesses across the country have delved into agritourism and diversified their product lines to generate as much revenue as possible. This isn't a new idea to Jeff Swanson, a tour manager at Country Dairy in Michigan.
That's part of the reason why we put in our own bottling plant, because in the late 70s and early 80s, milk prices were really low and a lot of farmers were selling out.
Country Dairy not only bottles its own milk, but also operates its own ice cream line, offers tours, and even has a small restaurant on its farm. Swanson says the idea of the special products and tours is also about helping people to understand farming.
People who really have a disconnect with farms today, to be able to educate them and help them know what a modern dairy farm is like.
Swanson says this has allowed their farm to remain relatively independent from major milk market forces. Their focus is to provide quality milk to their customers and offer some unique time on the farm.
So this year, we're also going to be doing classes on Thursdays, and we call it Moo University or Moo U. And we are doing that to try and open up farming even more to people.
That's been a recurring theme through conversations with different dairy farmers. These side businesses aren't just about bringing in more cash. They're also meant to connect people. I'm Tadeo Ruiz Sandoval, Harvest Public Media.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
What Trump may want from Greenland beyond minerals. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The world was on tenterhooks last week, awaiting Donald Trump's next move toward acquiring Greenland. Perhaps because markets tanked, he backed down from the threats to impose tariffs or use military force in favor of a vague framework that will give the U.S. access to the island, not dissimilar to an existing agreement.
Trump maintains that the United States needs Greenland for national security, but many suspect it's about extracting the island's vast mineral resources, including rare earth elements, or at least blocking China and Russia from grabbing them.
But harvesting the metals, which experts say might take years and could be technically and environmentally challenging, could be just the tip of the iceberg. The real treasure might be Greenland's water.
The island holds about 10% of the world's freshwater reserves, locked away in ice that would raise sea levels by 24 feet if fully melted by global warming.
Gaining control of water capital could be strategic. Last week, the UN proclaimed that the world has entered an era of global water bankruptcy, where many societies have not only overspent their annual renewable water income from rivers and snowpack, but have also depleted long-term savings in aquifers, glaciers, and wetlands.
Back in 2018, Ronald Lauder, heir to the Estee Lauder fortune, was allegedly the first to put a bug in Trump's ear to buy Greenland. Since then, Lauder has launched a venture to export spring water from the island and another to generate hydropower from Greenland's biggest lake to fuel an aluminum smelter.
Additionally, an official who served in the president's first term is planning a multi-billion-dollar data center on the island.
Given that two water-intensive industries, mining for minerals and data centers for AI, animate Trump, controlling a gigantic freshwater reservoir might be too tantalizing to ignore.
Despite warnings about the dangers of deep seabed mineral mining from scientists and other countries, the Trump administration is speeding up permitting of the practice.
Now, under a new process run by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, a company will be able to apply for a license to harvest the potato-sized rocks.
A recent study from the University of Hawaii at Manoa showed that seabed mining could have significant consequences for tiny animals at the bottom of the food chain that would then affect fisheries and food for humans.
However, Neil Jacobs, the administrator of NOAA, said in a statement that deep seabed mining for minerals like copper, zinc, and more is important to enable U.S. companies to access these resources quickly.
37 countries have called for a moratorium or ban on the practice, including France, Canada, and Germany.
The administration's new permitting process would allow companies to mine outside the continental boundaries of the U.S., a position that will likely be opposed by the International Seabed Authority, which has been working on rules for many years.
There might be another reason to be cautious about mining the seafloor. It might contain dark oxygen generated by the very metals companies seek to collect.
It's been thought that sunlight and photosynthesis were required to produce oxygen on a large scale, but there's no sunlight on the deep seabed, so how does it happen?
Scientists led by the Scottish Association for Marine Science say the nodules have been measured to produce nearly a volt of power, a bit less than a AA battery, that breaks down seawater into hydrogen and oxygen.
The scientists have designed two crafts that will dive to areas of the ocean where the pressure is about 1,200 times that on Earth's surface to learn more. And finally, on January 7th, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. unveiled new dietary guidelines for Americans. To make America healthy again, he proclaimed, we must return to basics and eat real food.
Eating real food means having fewer processed products and consuming less sugar. But the new guidelines also promote consuming nearly double the amount of meat and dairy to increase protein uptake, flipping the iconic food pyramid upside down.
That advice is not only a hard pill to swallow for nutrition experts, who say saturated fats from beef and dairy are linked to cardiovascular disease and some cancers, but also environmental groups and climate scientists, who say it's not healthy for our planet.
According to the World Resources Institute, beef and lamb have high environmental footprints, requiring more land and generating more water pollution per ounce of protein than most alternatives.
The group warns that a surge in meat eating by Americans could drive habitat and biodiversity loss through the conversion of forest lands into pastures. Also, ruminant animals like cows and sheep emit a lot of the planet-warming gas methane by belching.
Plant-based foods like beans, lentils, soy, and nuts, although great sources of protein and other nutrients like fiber and iron, were not emphasized in the new guidelines as much as beef, even though they're often more affordable.
While many Americans will just ignore the guidelines, the new framework will have implications for federal nutrition and education programs, as well as offerings at military and federal cafeterias.
That's it for this week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 27th. On this date, in 1971, a young man named Steve Blim scored 85 points during the Ramsey County basketball tournament in Starkweather. That's right, 85 points. Blim was playing for the Devil's Lake School for the Deaf, which beat Hamden 122-22. During his high school career, Blim scored 3,859 points, a state record that may never be broken. But that's not his only record. His four-year average of 41.5 points per game was a national high school record, as was his 35.8 average during his freshman year. In his sophomore year, he established another record, averaging more than 47 points per game, the highest ever average for a sophomore. Blim was unstoppable in all facets of the game, whether it was field goals, rebounds, or free throws. In his 4 years with the School for the Deaf, he made 827 points from free throws alone. He once made 17 free throws in one game. It wasn't that he was exceptionally tall. At a modest 5'11", he still managed a total of 1,352 rebounds while in high school. Blim probably would have risen to the top of his game no matter what, but he did overcome some challenges, having lost his hearing during childhood when a now-banned medicine was prescribed for ear infection. Radio broadcaster Lee Halverson called Blim one of the most mature young men he'd ever run into. Halverson used to do play-by-play for KDLR in Devil's Lake. He recalled an opposition coach saying they could win if they could hold Blim to 40 points, but Blim went out and scored 56. After high school, Blim went to Minot State for a semester, then transferred to Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. There, he was MVP in 1976 and 77. And in 1978, was named Gallaudet's Athlete of the Year. He also won a gold medal at the World Games for the Deaf in Romania. Blim wasn't perfect. Coach Brenner had to call in his fourth-grade son, Terry, to help Blim pack his equipment. "He was my idol, no question," Terry said, "but he would forget his shoes or his jersey or his athletic supporter. Most people would loan him things, except for the athletic supporter." Stephen was married to Linda Blim, now deceased. They raised three daughters, Vera, Maggie, and Sarah. He lives in Virginia, where he works for the United States Postal Service. In 2018, he was named Deaf Father of the Year by the Virginia Association of the Deaf. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio testifies before Congress for the first time since the U.S. attacked Venezuela.
Remember what Secretary Rubio says time and time again. He is implementing the president's policies.
How does Rubio explain to anxious lawmakers the president's foreign policy plans? That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's it for today's Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us. Tomorrow on the show, Bakken at a Crossroads. We'll visit with Nathan Anderson of the North Dakota Department of Mineral Resources about Continental Resources' pause in drilling and what it means for production and energy policy. Plus, on Prairie Plates, fresh made-from-scratch Mexican flavors and a family tradition at Maria's Homestyle Mexican in downtown Fargo. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.